Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored once again by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. The Business Creators Radio Show goes to those places where you have those mastermind meetings and discover those aha moments that can change your trajectory or at least bring you a little bit closer to serving from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. I invite you to picture yourself sitting in on a mastermind conversation and finding those little morsels of wisdom. We don't have a $25,000 high quality Hollywood studio because candidly, I'm a laptop lifestyle guy. I'm coming to you today sitting on my purple couch in my sumptuous Las Vegas apartment here in what some call the hottest city in America. I am surrounded by my podcast production team, which for those of you who are new means my cats. And we are going to have a conversation, the title of which is Uneducated. I love the uneducated, as somebody would say. Well, what this is about is the stigma of being the degreeless in the white-collar world and how this leads to social anxiety and imposter syndrome. That's a piece of it. But the other piece is we're going to be looking at some of the trends that we're seeing in terms of how companies assess applicants and recruits and the shifting of perceptions about the value of a degree or the necessity of a degree, which is still very much a work in progress, but something that's pretty hot in the employment and recruiting market right now. And to guide us on this journey, we have Christopher Zara. He is an author and journalist who writes about culture, media, business, and tech. He's a senior editor at Fast Company, where he runs the news desk and leads a team that covers everything from startups and big tech to workplace culture and finance. He's the author of a book called Uneducated, which is a memoir about navigating the professional white-collar world without a college degree. And it tells you about his struggles as a student with behavioral difficulties in the New Jersey public school system, and later his efforts to assimilate as a high school dropout in the pedigree-obsessed world of New York media. So we're touching on another thing here, which is my thoughts about the public education system and overall the mandatory education system here in the United States. So weaving together several of my own passion projects. Welcome, Christopher Zara. Come on in. The weather's fine.
Hello, Adam. Thank you so much for having me on. It's nice to be here.
Heck yeah. So what we do here, and if you've been, for those of our listeners who've checked this out, we have what we do is I will typically introduce the credentials of our guests. And what I've told you about Christopher is so impressive, I'm not sure that I'm worthy to be in his presence, and this is my show. So I do that part from the official bio, and then what we do is we turn it over to the guest. Pull back the curtain. And Christopher, what I want you to do is, in your own words, tell us a bit about your journey and what's brought you to where you are today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. I think you covered it actually pretty well. I mean, I am a journalist who covers the business space quite heavily. Fast Company is one of the leading business magazines with a strong focus on technology and design and innovation and all the really cool aspects of business, if you want to put it that way. I think we try to look at business through an innovation lens and through a lens of really trying to have business make the world a better place instead of a worse place, which it sometimes does.
Right.
My own personal journey comes into play with the book Uneducated that you just mentioned. Being a journalist, especially a business journalist who covers complicated topics like finance and startup culture and things like that. My own background as someone who not only didn't attend college, but really didn't finish high school, is unusual. And it put me in the position working in this business of media for such a long time that I thought I could bring an unusual perspective to the topic of higher education and college and how we treat that in the workplace, in the modern workplace today in offices. I learned pretty quickly that I was one of the few in the media world or in journalism that didn't go to college. And, you know, the neighborhood I came from, it wasn't unusual to not go to college. Like, it was a pretty normal thing. So it was a bit of a culture shock for me to then find myself surrounded by this very educated world where going to college is really seen as a necessary step. And so that's where the book came from. And I found, since I've written the book, I've gotten so much feedback from people who have had similar experiences, whether they didn't attend college or didn't go to the right college or didn't. Sometimes they feel like they, because they went to a state school, they don't measure up. There's all kinds of ways that education that we define ourselves based on our education and the people we surround ourselves with. So that's why I wanted to write the story. And the story is quite personal, but it's touched on, as you mentioned, I think a really big topic right now in the business world, which is how do we find talent in a way that doesn't shut out a large segment of the American population? When you look at the broad numbers, most people don't have college level education, and yet they're closed out of a lot of jobs and a lot of businesses. So that bigger topic is what I've been asked to talk about a lot since I've written the book. I did a talk on it at one of Fast Company's events a couple of months ago, where I discussed this with startup leaders and entrepreneurs and people who are in the position to hire, asking questions like, what do we do about this issue? Like, how do we assess skills over college degrees? So it's a really big issue, and it's a really fascinating one. It's been fascinating to watch that shift, because as someone who started in the media world, you know, almost 20 years ago now, these discussions, I feel like, were not happening at that time. So it's really been interesting to watch.
Yeah, I'm age-wise, I'm a Gen X millennial cusper. So I was born in the later mid-1970s. So basically what I am is... I'm basically a millennial, but it didn't happen until I reached college, if that makes sense.
So that's the best. Yeah, we were born in the same decade. I can put it to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just by looking at your publicity photo, I guess that we were probably in the same cohort. So just to put a frame. Yeah. So just to put a framework on something that, because again, I'm really passionate about what you're sharing with us, and I'm going to riff on this in just a moment. But first of all, if you don't mind sharing, you know, one of the things you alluded to in the green room is that something happened in high school that caused you to only make it to the 11th grade.
Yeah, so that's a different part of the story. But what happened there was, school was not very successful for me. And I did attend one of these public high schools in New Jersey that was quite overcrowded. It was the 1980s. There wasn't a lot of time. The teachers, you know, God bless them, didn't have a lot of time or energy to deal with students who were who had behavioral issues. And so when I entered my teen years, especially at 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, I was a really bad student. I didn't do well. I got mostly D's and then started to fail a lot of classes. And I also started to act out in a behavioral way. And the school system labeled me emotionally disturbed, which is a classification in special education that allows them to stick you in a special setting, essentially.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened to me. And it didn't let the special schools are not very accommodating. I there were a lot of fights there and a lot of violence, and I didn't last long at the special school. And that was the end of my high school career. And in my neighborhood, if you got kicked out of high school, that was usually it. There was not, you know, a lot of there wasn't a lot of attention put on higher education. I mean, people did go to college where I came from, but not many. And it was certainly not unusual to like leave high school and that was sort of the end of your school. So that was the end for me. I did get a GED that same year, but that's kind of as far as I went.
Right, right. So I was actually classified as gifted when I was in school, to the point where I was skipped from the first to the second grade right in the middle of the school year, and they did a whole ceremony about it. Wow. So you can imagine what happened to my social life for the entire rest of my educational journey.
That's interesting. I never thought of it from that perspective. My brother.
It's the one and only regret that my parents have in how they raised me is that if they had to do over again, they would not have allowed them to skip me from one grade to the next right in the middle of the year. And and then on the other hand, if it had been absolutely necessary for my well-being somehow, they would have moved me to a different school right in the middle of the year, along with the grade change, so that that stigma was not placed upon me because it caused me a lot of problems. Now,
so do you feel like you weren't ready to interact with the older kids? Is that it just feel like there was
that's part of it? Maturity thing? That was a big part of it. I felt constantly out of place. I never fit in. Basically, nobody liked me. There's another layer of this, which I'm going to get to in just a second. And I think it speaks to some of the trends today. So if I had to do the experience over again, you know, you mentioned you took your GED because of what happened and you got kicked out of high school.
Right.
If I had to do over again, I would have demanded to take the GED because I would have looked at it and said, you know what? There is a minimum required level that I need to do here. I've already done 10 times more than that. This place is taking such a toll on my mental health. I'm in a place where I'm not sure I'm going to live to grow up. That's how bad it was.
Yeah.
I'm going to take the damn test and walk away from this and you all have fun. Now, I feel I was lied to at the time because I was told, well, if you drop out of high school and you take the GED, then you're done. That's it. You might be lucky to work flipping burgers somewhere. Well, it turns out, and maybe this is more of a recent thing, but I'm being told that this was even somewhat the case even back in the mid 1990s when all this was going on.
Yeah.
Is that if you took the GED rather than getting a high school diploma, it wasn't the end of your life. You could actually still go to college, get accepted to a major university, but what they would typically do before they would accept you to like maybe a state school or an Ivy League or an elite private or something like that, is they would say, well, what we want you to do is we want you to do a year at community college just to show that you're serious about this and to fill in some of the gaps that might have been between your diploma and GED. So go do a year at community and reapply. And I found out that a number of people actually took that path. In fact, right around that time, my best friend at the time, his sister, quote unquote, dropped out of high school. And 2 years later, she was in college.
Yeah.
I don't mean community college. I mean, she actually was in a state school. So so even in the 1990s, it was quite possible. I don't know what her story was, why she didn't follow the officially designated path for completing secondary education, but it didn't slow her down one bit. I mean, and she has, the last time I checked, she has a really good lifestyle now.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think that like if you're really intentional about it like that, and you know you have this plan, you can definitely do it that way. I think in my case, the issue was I didn't have a plan, and I really didn't have a lot of adults around me at that time to help me with a plan.
The adults I had around me were the type who were telling me that my life was over. Another thing I wanted to do, and this is what I said I'd circle back to, and then I want to hear a lot more about your story here, is that after I survived high school, I wanted to take a year off before I went to college. And I don't like the term year off. I actually prefer the term that we use in today's world called gap year. And there were two reasons for it. One of which is, funny enough, I did have a job flipping burgers and I really liked it. I enjoyed that job. And I actually, you know, the senior year of what they call high school, My only memories of that year that I keep with me that I think about are my experiences working flipping burgers, because that was the only thing in my life that I felt was either fun or helping with my education. In fact, I feel I learned more working at that job than I did in school.
Yeah, so you do learn a lot at those kinds of jobs. I worked a lot of retail. I mean, for a decade after my high school experience, I was in retail and working in shopping malls and things like that. You learn a lot of workplace skills that really apply to anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, let's look at some of the things you can learn, as a line employee in fast food. You can learn about logistics. You can learn about supply chains. You can learn about staffing optimization. You can learn about teamwork. You can learn about organizational culture. You can learn about technical processes. You can learn about health safety. There are so many things that are part of that job, even if it looks like all you're doing is either flipping the burger or dropping the fries into the grease. But you need to have all those skills. And if you work there just a little while, you will by default acquire all of them if you want them.
I learned a lot about how profit margins worked when I worked at a Häagen-Dazs ice cream stand, which I actually worked at for like 3 years. And the bosses used to tell me, you know, measure it out and put it on a scale when you're scooping it, because each scoop matters. And if each scoop is just that tiny bit bigger, we lose profit. And they used to put the math like on not a chalkboard, but they'd write it down and say, this is what we lose if you put a bigger scoop in there.
Okay.
After like a week.
Right. So I worked at a Wendy's and our store was actually an officially designated training store, which means that's the one where they sent all the management trainees to do their 4 weeks before they got their management job and moved on to their assistant manager job in another store. So our store did not have a general manager. His title was training store manager, which meant he got paid 10% more basically, and he qualified for profit sharing. So I actually didn't like the guy at first. I thought he was kind of a jerk. But as I got to know him, I found out that he was actually one of the most erudite and nuanced individuals from whom I learned not only a lot about business, but also about some of the realities of succeeding in the world. In some ways, he was kind of a gray area sort of guy. He was a good guy, but he... you know, had his own path. And it taught me a lot about the human condition and how to relate to people, you know, finding them where they are at any given time. Now, those of us in the business world may think of Dr. Tony Alessandro's platinum rule. It was basically that, just translated into burgers. I didn't know about platinum rule until a few years later when I actually had the opportunity to have a conversation with Dr. Alessandro, and it was pretty enlightening. So finishing up that point is going back to where I was. If I had insisted on that gap year, which I really should have done, bear in mind, I was skipped from the first to the second grade, which means I also had the sociological disadvantage of always being the youngest. I was I was the last person to get a driver's license. I was the last person to turn 18. And I'm going to say a phrase that everybody in America will understand. Picture yourself being at Penn State University, not being able to walk into a bar and have a legal drink until the middle of your senior year. That's a crime.
Yeah.
That should never be allowed.
Yeah. Unless
you want to talk about disadvantage. That was a major college town, and it was a funded state university. Believe me, you weren't getting away with a fake ID up there.
They knew. Yeah. I had an older brother who kind of looked like me. So I would just use his old license like for the first couple of years. And that actually worked everywhere. I got in Atlantic City, all kinds of places with that.
Yeah. My sister had a best friend who looked just like her, who was 2 years older. She was probably getting into bars before I was, believe it or not. And that's a real travesty. That tells you how disadvantaged I was. But I didn't know anybody who looked like me, so I was kind of out of luck. So what I love about this is, and we go to neuroscience, and you know, we call people adults at age 18, even though we don't let them drink until they're 21. I don't understand that. You can vote and you can get drafted to get killed for your country, but you can't drink. That's ridiculous. It's like you're either an adult or you're not. But let's leave that debate aside.
It wasn't always like that, right? The generation right before me, they got had a little bit easier because they were allowed to drink at 18.
Exactly.
In some states. It really started to change, I think, in the 70s and 80s. And then by the time I was in high school, it was 21.
But exactly. Exactly. Also, it used to be that you had to be 21 to vote. So
that's true.
Now you can volunteer or be drafted for the military and be sent to a forward combat area, and you can vote, but you can't drink. Where it used to be, you could drink and go into military, but you couldn't vote.
Yes,
and exactly. now it's a big issue in the 1960s with the counterculture movement. It's like, you're drafting us to send us to Vietnam, and we don't even get a say in this.
Yeah, that's actually never thought of it that way, but you're right. Yeah, that's kind of messed up.
Yeah. So let's leave aside. I think it should be all one thing. You're either an adult or you're not. But that being said, when you look at it neuroscientifically, we're not really adults until we're in our mid to late 20s. They say something like 25, 26 is for most people right about when you truly become an adult, because the brain is physically still developing at a very fast pace up until that time. You're still acquiring a lot of knowledge and a lot of formation. So when I see somebody who's 25 years old and still living with their parents, my question is, okay, do you have a plan to move out into the next 5 years? Because up until now, you've basically been a kid. I mean, I didn't leave my parents' house until I was 28. But part of the reason for that is I was, first of all, pursuing my MBA, which I got, while working a full-time job. So I didn't want to deal with an apartment. And then I caught the entrepreneurial bug. So I was still working a full-time job and building a business. And I didn't want the maintenance of having my own place. Plus, I wanted to take as much money as possible and reinvest it in that business, which means if I wasn't paying rent, I was growing a business.
Yeah.
But I tell you, as soon as I got that business up full-time, I was out of there in 45 days. But it was all part of the plan.
Yeah, that was pretty normal, I think, for people in my neighborhood to live with their parents for years too. I don't think that was unusual. I got out when I was 25 of my family's house. I had a different issue. I had like these drug issues, so I had to basically leave the state so I could get sober, and this was all the thing.
I mean, we had different experiences, but we had faced some similar issues here. So, I'm just curious. I mean, how did you become an editor at a leading business magazine in New York City with only a GED? Because I know enough about traditional and legacy media to know that education credentials are everything. So how did you pull it off?
Well, it's a lot of lucky breaks, a lot of being at the right place at the right time, a lot of hard work. I mean, so essentially what happened was I'm probably like, mid 30s and still working retail jobs. And really at this point saying, I need to change my life and do something different, do something real. I was very unhappy in my early to mid 30s. And so I decided I'm going to try to pursue a writing career. And I came to New York City. I didn't really know what journalism was. I knew enough about it that I knew how to do it, which kind of is a weird way to say it, but like, I didn't know the business. I didn't know other journalists. I didn't know how it worked. I came to New York City and I got an internship. It was unpaid. At a newspaper that was called Show Business Weekly. And it was one of these actor trade papers for Broadway, covered the business of entertainment, the business of theater. It was a really business focused newspaper. The problem with it was that it was a dying newspaper and a dying business model. This was 2005 and no one was reading these kinds of newspapers anymore. Everyone was finding this information online. So it was good and bad. It was good in the sense that I got to be thrown into this situation where because someone left, I became an editor there and then was suddenly really kind of running the whole editorial department at this small newspaper. So I learned everything about the newspaper business, about journalism, all these little on a very small scale.
Yeah.
The problem was that the business model was already doomed when I got there, and it was not a viable place to build a career, because the newspaper was never going to last more than a few more years. But I did get almost 6 years there. And in that 6 years, I learned basically the business of journalism. And, you know, when that paper folded, I had enough under my belt that I could find other work doing it. And then I found another job at an online publication called International Business Times. And this was right around the time when all these online publications, Business Insider, Huffington Post, what are some of the other ones that were really big? BuzzFeed, all these were all like exploding at this time when I first joined that place. And
yeah,
it was like a gold mine for us. For a hot second, everyone thought online media was going to be this really profitable industry. It's really hilarious to think of it now.
I know. And some of those companies you listed have had some serious financial troubles now.
Exactly.
And I think part of that is actually just the changing environment has led them to have to do massive restructuring. I mean, I think part of it was mismanagement, but another part of it is just the market changed really fast and really dramatically.
It was a wild ride for me, because when we were at IBT Media, which is what they called themselves, they bought Newsweek. They were growing at this like crazy pace. And this was like mid 2010s. So it was like 2016. Mm-hmm. Everyone just thought there was like this kind of business model was like sustainable, but it was all based on this enormous growth of audience that was not sustainable. You just can't keep growing. And BuzzFeed learned this too. Like, yeah, you're growing 1 year and growing the next year, but you can't keep doing that. And eventually the advertisers catch on, or they find other places to go. It becomes really difficult to make money selling digital ads. Everyone knows now, I think, that it's a really difficult business. But
it is. I mean, what's happening with digital ads now is what happened to print ads 10 years ago. I mean the idea of actually being in a business where you connected advertisers and newspapers doesn't exist anymore, because at this point, you want to put an ad in a newspaper, you just call the newspaper. They will rush to take your call and get your money.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know how many people you're going to reach with a local newspaper these days.
That I don't remember last time I've seen a local newspaper. I'm in Las Vegas. I read the Review Journal, but I haven't held one in my hands in a long time. I think I might see them at the supermarket, but I go to RJ.com.
Yeah, I mean, I still love to read the Financial Times and the New York Times in print, but I don't see a lot of classifieds ads in there, and the classified ads is what really used to sustain these businesses. But the bigger point here is that there were basically two business models that I watched collapse within the span of, I would say, 10 or 12 years in journalism. It was first watching this newspaper collapse from under me, which was really hard to do because I did want it to succeed. And then the second was getting into the online media game and watching that kind of build and then collapse also within the span of a few years. These were big life lessons about how business works and about how it's constantly being disrupted. Now everyone's talking about AI like suddenly this year. So it now again feels like we're in this moment where the floor is shifting under us. And it's like, It's the media world has always felt like that to me. I'm not old enough to remember when it was ever stable.
Yeah, right. So overall, you have this lack of a quote unquote formal education.
Yeah.
So what impacts has that had on your overall approach to news coverage? I know that's a broad question. So if you could bring that in for us a little bit.
Yeah, these were things I noticed, I think, slowly over time. I mean, one of the things I really wanted to do especially when I first got to Fast Company, because it was it's well established, well liked, and I didn't know a ton about it. So I had to learn how to adapt and fit into that world. I've been there about 7 years now, but when I first got there, my MO was really just to fit in. I went to all the events. I did all the things you're supposed to do. I met with startup founders and interviewed CEOs and things like that. But I did notice a pattern right around the 2016 election. When Trump was rising in popularity, and there was a lot of talk about the white working class and how that was discussed. There was a lot of talk about education as this big fault line for politics. And there still is. I mean, if you look at the data, I think there's definitely truth to that. Like, so I felt like at that time, you know, to be honest, like I didn't cover it in the way that I really wanted to, because I was afraid to out myself, if that makes sense.
I get what you mean. Now, this is not a political podcast. I don't want to go down this road. I'm only going to say this just to help and, you know, inform your point even further. But, you know, when you think of President Trump, you think of him saying, "I love the uneducated." That's one of the phrases that he's said at the various rallies and speeches that has just really become not only a catchphrase, but part of our lexicon. I love the uneducated. I love the uneducated. Yeah. And and also, full disclosure, I voted for him both times. I imagine it might be different for some of our listeners. Maybe the same or different for you. I don't know. And the only reason I'm saying that, because I want to explain very briefly why, because I think it's important to this conversation. I like some of his policies. In our political system, you're not going to find any candidate that lines up 100% with every single thing you want, like a smorgasbord. So they say choose a lesser of two evils. Maybe once in a while, you're going to find one where you agree with maybe 50 to 60% of what they're proposing. His first, you know, his 2016 platform, I think I liked about 70% of it. But the main reason is I felt that our political system and our society needed shaken up. And who better to do that than somebody with a lifelong reputation as a wrecking ball?
I even
said at the time, his role would be to shake things up. Reforming and rebuilding would be the role of his successor, whoever that would be.
Yeah, so we're there now. I mean, I hope we can see that the wrecking ball analogy is actually a good one, because that's what happened. And you know, I would argue, you know, if we're being transparent about it, my own feeling about it in 2016 was the exact opposite. I didn't want to wreck.
Yeah,
I still don't.
Right.
You know, to get back to how I covered in the news world, like, you know, I did feel like there was this narrative that people who didn't graduate college were obviously Trump supporters, and I was not. So like, this was, you know, this was to me already this narrative that was being put out there. And I do wish I had covered it differently, but I wanted to. There was such an intense like desire on my part to fit in with my colleagues, and that's what I did in that era, in that time period.
Yeah, and let's remember again, your book is called Uneducated, and your whole life story is about being quote unquote uneducated. Yeah. So first of all, Donald Trump loved you, so just know that you can feel his love because he loves the uneducated. But it also raised that question of, is how do we define educated? And one of the things I'm loving to a degree, and I'd like to see more of it, is you're seeing companies like Google, GM, IBM, that are starting to relax their degree requirements now. I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm originally from Pennsylvania. And in Pennsylvania, as far as their requirements for certain government jobs at the state level, the Commonwealth level, they're also significantly reducing their degree requirements and changing the focus to the ability to pass a civil service test with a combination of actual experience.
Yeah, a lot of states are doing that now. I think my own home state of New Jersey recently did the same thing. I'm not sure about New York yet, but that's those two things are happening at the same time with the big companies you just mentioned, Google and IBM and Delta Airlines. They're right around, you know, I think they've been doing this for a while, but the pandemic really sort of accelerated it with the labor shortages that they've been facing. They've realized they need to open up their talent pools to more people. And one of the best ways to do that is to measure people differently and not just look at this one credential, this academic credential, as the deciding factor on whether or not you hire people. So what I think's happened is they're trying to be a little bit more intentional about how they find their talent and to different, I think, probably varying degrees of success. But I'm glad it's happening, and I'm glad people are talking about it, because for a long time, there were places that you just couldn't get into. There was no, you know, my own experience aside, I think I'm an anomaly in the sense that I just got lucky that people didn't ask.
Yeah.
But most people don't have that experience, especially now with these these application tracking systems that everyone has. Uh-huh. Like, it's impossible to get through those kinds of systems. So I am glad that there is a willingness on the part of these big companies to rethink how they hire.
I think that's really, really good. I mean, I would be what you would consider the educated. I completed my degree at Penn State, and I went on to Duquesne University and got my MBA. So
yeah,
I would be among the highly educated.
Those are good schools. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel that I gained a lot from those experiences. Now, if I had to do them over again, I would, but I would approach them differently. So
it's funny because, like, if I had it to do over again, I would love to go back and do it the right way. Like, this is part of the big part of the book, actually, is just my, you know, sort of realizing what I missed out on. And part of realizing it was because I work with so many great colleagues who all attended these great schools. And it did make me realize, wow, there's something I missed out on. When I was a kid, you know, when I was a teenager, I worked on the campus of Princeton University in one of the dining clubs, serving foods to people a lot richer than me. I think even Brooke Shields was there at the time. And that campus is one of the most beautiful campuses in the country that I've ever seen. I live also near Columbia University now, that another beautiful campus. But like, when I go on these campuses, I just have this yearning for like something that I never had.
Yeah. Well, here's my thought about it. I chose Penn State because I wanted to go to a big school. I came from a really small town, and we've already covered my experiences and the education system there. We don't need to revisit that. Plus, I want to make sure we have plenty of time because we have a few other points I want to cover. Yeah. But what I liked about Penn State is I did my first 2 years at a branch campus, which, you know, in their terminology, they call them Commonwealth campuses, but it was a branch campus. And then after that, I transferred to State College, University Park, and where there are, I think, 40,000 students, or at least at the time there were 40,000 students. It's a bigger number now. And what I loved about it is the fact that it was so big, and I didn't have to find a clique to fit in with just to survive. I didn't have to have those feelings of being an outsider because I wasn't accepted by a certain group of people. And I also could be parts of different groups and different things. Like, I could be three different things in one day. I mean, I could be the student sitting in the front row diligently taking notes in class. Then mid to late evening, I go down to the student union building and I play board games. And then after that, I go down to the bars and get freaking smashed.
Yeah.
Those are three different lifestyles, plus some other things you can explore in a type of university environment that we don't really need to discuss on this call, but I think our listeners can fill in their own meanings as to what that is. And that's part of the university experience. So if I had to do it over again, there's two changes I would have made. Change number one is I would have done a hell of a lot more of what I just described. Change number two is I wouldn't have worried about my grades so much.
You needed the grades to get into the master's program.
Let me, I'm going to develop that for you in just a second.
Okay.
Yeah. When I was in high school, my overall grade point average was just below 3.5 on the 4.0 scale, which means I never qualified for this thing called the National Honor Society, which I was told, if you don't belong to the National Honor Society, you're never going to get to a good college, and you might as well get ready for a $35,000 a year job working in a grunt position. Okay. Well, the National Honor Society, and I'm not putting them down, but basically that's a membership club. It has really no impact other than a line on your resume. I did finish high school with a 3.5 grade point average because in the final 9 weeks of my senior year, a grade I got on a 10-point quiz in my English class rounded up and kicked the whole thing over the 3.5. They wanted me to go to the graduation ceremony, which I wanted to skip first off, but since I was forced to go to it, they wanted me to wear the gold cord and the blue cord that would indicate that I was honors. But the fact is, I was graduating high honors, so I should have the two yellow cords. But they tried to say, well, we only count up until the third 9-week period, so your honors. Like, no, I'm high honors. I'm graduating with a 3.52. So I did wear the two gold cords because they relented. But if it hadn't been for that, my uncle had already loaned me. He still had his gold cord from when he had graduated. And I was just going to, while I was in the audience waiting to be called up, I was going to just take off the blue cord and put on my uncle's yellow cord. So I had two yellow ones and dare them to say something.
Do the old switcheroo. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So, you know when the last time anybody ever asked what my grade point average was in high school?
I can't imagine.
The people of Penn State. As soon as they were satisfied they had the financial aid, I mean grades, they let me in. I finished Penn State with something like it was something like a 3.51. I don't have it in front of me, and I'm off by like 0.3, a 3.51 overall. But there's a separate QPA for your major where I had a 3.7. So if I had to do it again, I would have not pulled all nighters over gen ed classes, which you know, I would have just gone all in. I would have gotten as close as to I could to a 4.0 on the major classes. And as long as I was 3-something and the rest of it, I was fine. Because the last time anybody asked about my, grades at Penn State is Duquesne University. When they were making sure could get the funding to pay for it. Last time anybody ever asked. So, and a little bit more about the MBA. I entered the MBA program 2 years after I finished undergrad. So I finished undergrad. I had a couple jobs, one of which was so bad, I actually wrote a chapter in a book about it, Journeys to Success, a Millennial Edition. I celebrate the day I was fired as my second birthday, April 27th, and for reasons that are covered in a book. One of those jobs was working as a recruiter for a temporary staffing agency. So one of my contacts was the head of the human resource department for both graduate and undergrad at Duquesne University. His name was Dr. Jay Leibowitz. He's retired now. He's a great guy. And so one day, and I was used to interacting with him because every time we needed to place somebody on a temp assignment as a recruiter or an HR analyst or something, he was my first call, and he sent me a lot of great referrals, people who are looking for temp work. So I called him up one day and I said, you know, I've been thinking about this MBA. And he said, yeah, when are you going to apply? I said, I don't know. I graduated from Penn State with a degree in political science, and that was 2 years ago. So do you want somebody with a non-business degree who's been out of school for 2 years? And he said, well, actually, you're the perfect candidate because you've been in the world. You've seen how business works. You're going to appreciate the MBA more as you understand the problems and how what we teach you in the MBA is going to help you solve those problems. Plus, think about it. You come into my program, you get a concentration in HR management, which was my concentration, by the way. And combine that with your undergrad, you could become an HR director for Exxon or Amco, some big oil company. And I'd never thought of it that way. So the political science, which means we're getting into international politics, geopolitics, which is a big deal when you're in the oil industry.
Yeah.
Combine that with my work experience in my MBA. Oh, okay. Yeah. So I definitely applied and I absolutely got in. So the other point I want to make there is the whole idea that just because you pause your education, there's a gap, doesn't mean you lose your skills. In fact, what I found more and more is that people will tell you to lose your skills if you don't do it are the ones who profit by you forcing ahead when maybe you shouldn't.
Yeah, and this is a point I've made too. Like, you know, you obviously have firsthand experience with this because you attended the schools and went through the process. A part of my perspective as someone who covers the business world is that it's the schools that really profit from the system that we have right now.
Yeah.
And this is, again, not an anti-college statement in any way.
Right.
I think like part of the thing I like to say when I'm talking about this book is like, this is not an anti-college book and I'm not an anti-college person at all. In fact, I, you know, really, again, no. like I, as I mentioned earlier, like wish I had gone. But there is, we have a system right now. I think as we discuss, it's getting better. It's changing, but we still do have a system that's pretty much geared toward one type of credential, and that's the college degree. And who benefits from that? it's the schools, because that they can charge the premium, right? And they can sort of set the tone because we need them, because workers need them, because the business, because everybody needs them for the networking and everything. So like, I think that if we had a system where the Googles of the world were thinking differently about how to hire and who to hire, we might have a world where the schools have a little bit less of a stranglehold over the broader system, and that might be a better system.
Yeah, it could possibly be. So think about some other things that are going on, like the high schools. One of the reasons that they don't want some student to show up and say, you know what, I need 21 credits to graduate. I'm just going to do this in 3 years. They don't want you to do that. They want you to sit there the whole 4 years. Oh, and they don't want you to homeschool either.
Yeah, you know, I can imagine.
The reason why is very simple. They get funding based on headcounts.
Yeah.
If students find out that they can legally crack the code, because one path could have been, I could have taken a GED, and another could have been is, all right, I'm going to do this for 3 years, no study halls. I just forget study hall. I'll just take another class. Oh, and there's this little thing that since you have to take 4 English classes, you're actually allowed to take junior and senior English at the same time.
You know, the special education system works that way too. I don't know a ton about this because I only just started to research it because of my own experience, but it's based on headcount. Like how many students are in the special education system determines how much money schools will get, districts,
right,
like that, for the next years or whatever. So there's definitely an incentive to, you know, if you work in those systems, to have students in them.
Right.
Not always to the benefit of students.
Well, yeah. In my day, if somebody was had a behavior issue, like they were getting in fights or doing things that got them suspended several times or whatever, they would be rerouted into what was called alternative education, which was described to those of us who didn't know it as basically the next step toward a lifetime in prison. But you know, the funny thing is just for kicks, I still remembered a few of the names of the people who had gone into the alternative education program because they'd been in a couple of my classes. And ironically, those are the ones that I could sort of get along with. It's funny how that works. That should have been an indicator. And so I looked up a few of the names and I saw, oh, wait, this guy, he was in alternative education. He's a $10 million producer realtor. Oh, her. Wait, she's a financial advisor with a $100 million portfolio. Oh no. Oh wait, this guy. He's a general contractor building $500,000 houses. Wait, I thought these were the losers. I thought these were the cases that they'd given up on.
So that would be a good thing.
Yeah. So that got me thinking. Did getting out of the regular high school environment help them in some way that may not have been immediately apparent? And what you alluded to is something that's not exactly a new thought to me, is were they looking for a certain headcount, the alternative education program? So they were just basically looking at, okay, we got to find X number of people. So let's just look at who's been in the most fights and we'll just toss them in there.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible that there's that bit of head counting that goes on.
Yeah.
again, I don't know a ton about how that works. I have researched it a bit recently, because I was working on an op-ed about the label emotionally disturbed, which is a terrible label that no one likes. It's been around since the 60s. And it got into the federal education law, special education law, and it's still used today. But no one seems to like it. When I really researched the origins of the term, what it means, how it's diagnosed, and all these different things, all I kept seeing was criticism of it. And yet there it is in federal law, and no one's changed it. So it's kind of an interesting journey there for this one term that affects really hundreds of thousands of kids each year, because it determines what schools they're allowed to go to.
Yep. Trump wrecking ball. He said he was going to smash that whole thing up. And that's what I meant by I felt we needed a wrecking ball, while acknowledging that there was going to need to be a separate rebuilding process. Because I look at it this way. Let's say that you wanted to build a house somewhere. So you find this nice piece of land. It's about an acre. It's got a nice yard. You can do a little farm if you want. If you have kids, there's plenty of room for them to play. You can put it in a gazebo and all that. And on this land, there is this decrepit old house that's one step away from condemnation. So you want to tear down that old house and build your dream house. You're going to bring in one company to demolish the old house and clear the space, but you're going to hire another company to build the new house, simply because different phases, different skills, different competencies.
That's true. But what happens when the company that you hired to destroy the house then just wants to stay on the lot and doesn't leave?
Most demolition companies don't do that. I saw what you did there. I know, you know, we have a wide range of listeners who have all kinds of different opinions on that. So I'm not going to share what mine is. But what I will say is, going along with that analogy, it's also part of the demolition company's job typically to clear the space, which means take out all the debris, take out all the rubble. An alternative to that is you bring in another person who, picks up all the wiring and sells the copper, or comes in and takes the lumber because they can repurpose it or what have you. So sometimes people will tear down the old house and they'll say, okay, well, I'm going to bring so-and-so who are going to buy this stuff from me, or they'll pay the demolition company to just haul it all off. But the bottom line is there's supposed to be an empty space there where you can build a new house.
I would just add to that, you know, even demolishing something takes a lot of skill and careful planning. We have a lot of big buildings in New York City, for example. One of my favorite hotels, the Hotel Pennsylvania, they just demolished it. If you saw the way they did that, the planning that went into the scaffolding that has to go up around it so they can like take it down from the middle. And it's like, it's amazing. Like it's almost a work of genius to dismantle something like that. So I see what you're saying, but I also think that if you're going to find the person to dismantle, it's got to be, again, I think the right person, and we can disagree on who that is.
That's the beauty of our system, is we can have these conversations. We can bring our different viewpoints and between the two of us or the group of us, we can collectively come up with better solutions than each of us could do on our own, simply because we put all of our ideas out there and we find the best of the best.
That's true. It takes a lot of different ideas.
Yeah. And that's what I think is a closing thought before I tell people where to go to connect with you further, is that, when we look at different types of qualifications for jobs and careers, we bring in different perspectives, because the so-called uneducated bring things to the table that people who have done nothing but be in the classroom don't have. And the people who have done the entire classroom route have a different perspective that makes the street smart version even smarter.
I agree. I think it takes both of those kinds of people to make things work properly. And I think that, like, my own workplace experience shows that. I get along with everybody. And I don't mostly, and not everybody. No one gets along with everybody, but I get along with most people. And you know, I don't sit around and ask where they came from or what kind of school they went to. Like, it's not about that when you're in a work environment.
You know, I applied for a job once, and it was a small entrepreneurial thing, and I remember. They ended up actually not hiring me because they decided not to create a position. They were interviewing me because they were thinking about creating a position, but they decided ultimately not to, which was fine. But I remember the guy, he was a man, I think he was in his 50s. He had founded the company. It was a $5 million company. It was on the rise. And he said to me, you know, I saw your resume and all that, and I see you went to Penn State, and that's great. And I'm sure that if we decide that we can work together, that you're going to bring a lot to the table from that. But the bottom line is, when I look at people I want to hire, whatever school you went to is the right one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And I think about that, regardless of what college or university or technical school or whatever you went to, or whether your education was the street smart version, it was the right one.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah. The branding is so powerful, though, and this is the thing that I have noticed. In the journalism business, there are particular schools that really sing. The names just sing. Columbia J School or North.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
And so, like, the branding is really powerful. And like, uh-huh. Even for myself, I'm in a hiring position at times. You know, I didn't go to college, I didn't finish high school, but when I see those resumes like that, you know, it's hard. It's really hard to not be. Have that feel the allure of those schools and what they mean and what they symbolize.
Yeah, like I can tell you, if you're in engineering, agriculture, or sociology, Penn State is a big plus.
Yeah,
because those are three things that university is known for. So yeah,
probably for good reason, I imagine.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, all their programs are excellent, but those are three of the areas where they just have a really great reputation, and sometimes just having that line on your resume opens a door.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, but at the same time, we want to make sure that anybody who can do those jobs has the opportunity to open that door too. And I really have enjoyed this conversation and us putting some ideas out there so our listeners can draw their own conclusions and decide. How they feel about it. So here's what I want our listeners to do as we wrap up here. You got to check out Christopher Zara's website, and it's basically his name. It's ChristopherZara.com. So ChristopherZara.com. If you're on our website, go to the show notes, you'll see the link. When you go to that website, you're going to see a link right at the top of the front page, and it's a link to buy The Uneducated Book. Book list says that Zara writes a necessary and inspiring story about how we are more than our educational histories, and I could not agree more. So we've touched on a little bit of Christopher's journey. He and I have gone back and forth in mastermind format about some of our thoughts about credentialization, degrees, the education system in general, and some societal trends. This book takes it to a whole other level, and I am absolutely going to have to go pick up my copy as well. You can get a hardcover, you can get an ebook, and you can get an audiobook. So make sure to go to www.christopherzara.com and pick that up. And with that, Christopher, thank you so much. It has been an honor, and believe me, an education.
Thank you. thank you for having me. It's been really great. I've enjoyed this very much.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.